Chapter 25, The Discreet Charm of the Meritocracy. A more outlandish quartet hadn't set foot, belly, claw, and jaw on sojourn in 20 years. A half-breed Thelan female, her hut master, his Twillick majordomo, and his Chevin chief of security crossed the fort's leaf-littered courtyard and entered Plagueis' reception room. With the exception of the Thelan, they looked as if they might have wandered in from the Greel forests to consort with the creatures that had constructed nests and burrows in the fort's dank corridors and lofty turrets. Plagueis and 114D were waiting just inside the gaping entrance.
"Welcome, Jabba the Silagic Tayor," Plagueis said through his transpirator mask.
Droids had restored some semblance of order to the room and installed tables and chairs. Morning light streamed through square openings high in the wall, and a fire crackled in the stone hearth.
"A pleasure to see you again after so many years, Magister Damask,"
Jabba said in coarse basic. The ageless criminal lolled his huge tongue and maneuvered his great slug body onto a low platform the droids had erected. Gazing around, he added,
"You and your droid must visit my little place on Tatooine in the western Dune Sea."
"Someday soon,"
Plagueis said, as he lowered himself into an armchair across from the platform. Like Toydarians and Yenchori, Hutts were immune to Force suggestions. Had Jabba known how many of his species Plagueis had experimented on over the decades, he might not have been as sociable, but then the Hutts' own penchant for ruthlessness and torture were legendary. As a tattoo on his arm attested, he cared only for members of his clan. He didn't bother to introduce his subordinates by name, but, as was often the case with many of the thugs and ne'er-do-wells with whom he surrounded himself, two of them had reputations that preceded them. The pink-complexioned Twillick was Bib Fortuna, a former spice smuggler whose own species had turned its back on him. Tall and red-eyed, he had sharp little teeth and thick, shiny leku growing from a hairless cranium that looked as if it had been inexpertly stuffed with rocks. The Chevin, a 2-meter-high snout that had sprouted arms, legs, and tail, was Ifant Mon, celebrated as a warrior among his own kind and mildly Force-sensitive. He wore a blanket someone might have thrown over him to hide his ugliness. Plagueis knew from contacts in the Trade Federation that Mon was involved in a smuggling operation on technophobic Syria, supplying swoops to a gang of young upstarts. The Thelan was unknown to Plagueis. Pale and shapely, she had lustrous orange hair and purple beauty marks that ran down her face and neck to disappear beneath a revealing costume.
"Diva Shaliqua,"
Jabba said when he realized that Plagueis was studying her.
"A singer in the band."
"As her name suggests."
"A gift from Ingoda, in place of credits owed to me."
Jabba's big eyes settled on the Thelan.
"She and Diva Funquita came as a pair, but I made Funquita a present to Bardulla in the hope of smoothing over our lingering rivalry. My first mistake. The second, introducing Shaliqua to Romeo Treblank, who would move worlds to possess her.
Notorious for his gambling, Treblank owned the galaxy's opera house on Coruscant. Why Jabba chose to associate with gamblers and other lowlifes was a mystery to Plagueis. In some ways, the Hutt's illicit empire was the inverse of Higo Damask's, where, if nothing else, the criminals were at least politicians, corporate honchos, and financiers. His coming to sojourn was both uncharacteristic and unexpected.
"Are you here to talk about Treblank or Gardulla?"
Plagueis asked. Jabba reacted in annoyance.
As always, straight to the heart of the matter. But I can appreciate the fact that you're a busy Mune.
He wriggled to adjust his position on the platform.
I know you were instrumental 30 years ago in giving Gardula the run of Tatooine as a base for her slavery operations and pod racing events. I've come this far to inform you that Tatooine will soon have a new overseer.
He gestured to himself.
Me.
Plagueis said nothing for a long moment.
I was under the impression that Tatooine was already as much yours as Gardula's.
Appearances can't be deceiving. I've tried to undermine her influence by fomenting distrust among the so-called Sand People, the Tusken Raiders. But success at chasing her off-world continues to elude me.
Plagueis made an adjustment to the breath mask.
How can I help?
Jabba appraised him.
I happen to know that Ardula hasn't been able to make good on the loans you extended. What she earns from events like the Boonta Eve Classic, she loses to gamblers.
That much is true, but what of it?
I want you to stop funding her, so I can starve her out.
Plagueis shrugged.
Your information is incomplete, Jabba. I haven't funded her enterprises in a decade.
Jabba balled his hands in anger.
You have influence over members of the Banking Clan and the Trade Federation who are funding her.
Plagueis lifted his head, as if in revelation.
I see. And what can I expect in exchange?
To start with, a better percentage of the profits from the races and other enterprises.
Plagueis frowned in disappointment.
You must know that I've no need of credits, Jabba. And you wouldn't have come this far, as you say, unless you had learned a few things that might sway me over to your side.
Jabba wriggled, restraining his anger.
In return for your help, I will weaken Black Sun's influence with the Trade Federation Directorate.
I need no assistance.
Plagueis leaned forward in the armchair.
What do you know that I may not know?
Jabba inflated his body, then allowed the air to escape him in a protracted, mirthless laugh.
I know something you may not yet know about the Bandogora.
Plagueis raised himself somewhat in the chair. Hideously masked, Bandogora assassins had become a growing concern in the Outer Rim, posing a problem to the leadership of some of the cartels Plagueis backed.
Now you have my interest, Jabba.
The cult has a new leader.
Jabba went on, happy to have the high ground.
A human female. She has entered into a plan with Gardula. A Malastare dub named Sibolto, and a Republic senator to distribute contaminated death sticks as a means of supplying the Bandogora with brain-dead recruits.
Plagueis stretched out with a force to peer into the hut. Jabba wasn't lying.
This human female...
I've heard rumors.
Again, Jabba was telling the truth.
Rumors will suffice for now.
The hut rubbed his meaty hands together.
Her name is Komare Voza, and word has it that she is a former Jedi.
Plagueis knew the name only too well. Some 10 years earlier, Komare Voza, had been a Padawan of Master Dooku. Behind each of the Rotunda's hover platform docking stations extended wedge-shaped office complexes more than half a kilometer in length, where senators met with one another, entertained guests, and on rare occasions carried out the work they had been elected or appointed to perform. Some of the offices were sealed environments in which the atmospheres of member worlds were replicated. Others, especially those belonging to hive species, were staffed by hundreds of beings who performed their duties in cubicles that resembled nectar comb cells. By comparison, Naboo's was rather prosaic in design and adornment, and yet unrivaled in terms of the number of high-profile visitors it received.
"I'm giving thought to leaving the Order," Master Dooku told Palpatine in the windowless room that was the Senator's private study. "I can no longer abide the decisions of the Council, and I have to be free to speak my mind about the wretched state of the Republic." Palpatine didn't reply, but thought,
"Finally."
With Darth Maul traveling to Dorvala on his first mission, Palpatine had been preoccupied all afternoon, and now Dooku's disclosure, long anticipated, and yet still something of a surprise.
"This isn't the first time you've been exasperated with the Council," he said carefully. "And it probably won't be the last."
Dooku shook his head firmly.
"Never more than this. Even after Galadron, I've no recourse."
Frigid Galadron was years behind him, but for Dooku the incident remained an open wound. A local governor had succeeded in luring the Jedi into a conflict with Mandalorian mercenaries that had left 11 Jedi dead, and the true Mandalorians, largely innocent of the charges that had been leveled against them, wiped out, save for one. Since then, and on each occasion he and Palpatine had met, Dooku had begun to look less and less like a Jedi master, and more like the noble he would have been on his native Serenno. Meticulously groomed, he carried himself like an aristocrat, affecting tailored tunics and trousers, and a velvety black cloak that gave him a dashing theatrical look. His slightly curved lightsaber hilt, too, might have been a prop, though he was known to be one of the Order's most skilled duelists. And behind a mask of arrogant civility, Palpatine knew him to be capable of great cruelty.
"By request from the Senate," Dooku went on, "the Council dispatched several Jedi to Baltizar, and my former Padawan somehow succeeded in accompanying them."
Palpatine nodded soberly.
"I know something of that. Baltizar's senator petitioned for help in fending off attacks by the Bando Gora."
"Sadistic abductors and assassins," Dooku said in anger. "Military action was called for, not Jedi intercession. But no matter. The Council complied with the request, and now Komare Voza and the others are believed to be dead."
Palpatine raised an eyebrow.
"The young woman who became infatuated with you?"
"The same," Dooku said quietly. "At Galadran, she fought brutally against the Mandalorians. Almost as if in an attempt to impress me. As a result, I told the Council that she wasn't ready for the trials and Jedi knighthood. Compounding their initial error in dispatching Jedi, Master Yoda and the rest have refused to send reinforcements to search for survivors."
Palpatine considered it.
"If Baltizar was meant to be another attempt to impress you, all Komare Voza did was prove that you were right about her all along."
Dooku regarded him.
"Perhaps, but the failure is mine."
He ran a hand over his short beard.
"As skilled as I am with a lightsaber, I've turned out to be an ineffectual teacher. Master Qui-Gon Jinn has become a solitary and secretive rogue. And now Voza,
he snorted.
I declined to be a member of the Council in order to devote myself to diplomacy, and look how that has turned out. The Republic is sliding deeper into chaos.
You're one man against a galaxy full of scoundrels, Palpatine said.
Dooku's eyes flashed.
One man should be able to make a difference if he is powerful enough.
Palpatine let the silence linger.
You would claim the title of Count of Sereno?
By right of birth. My family is agreeable. Now it's simply a matter of informing the High Council.
Has anyone ever left the Order?
19 before me.
Have you shared your discontent with any of them?
Only Master Sifo Dyas.
Of course.
Dooku looked up.
He worries that I'm going to do something rash.
Leaving the Order isn't rash enough.
He fears that I will denounce the Council openly and reveal how divided its members are about answering to the Senate.
He looked Palpatine in the eye.
I've half a mind to join your cause.
Palpatine touched his chest.
My cause?
Dooku adopted a sly smile.
I understand politics, my friend. I know that you have to be circumspect about what you say and to whom.
But that the disenfranchised worlds of the Outer Rim enjoy any support at all is largely due to you.
You speak honestly and you champion the underprivileged. And you may be the only one capable of bringing the Republic back from the brink. Unless, of course, you have been lying to me all these years.
Palpatine made light of the remark.
Perhaps a few lies of omission.
Those I am willing to forgive, Dooku said. Whether or not we become partners in addition to being allies.
Palpatine interlocked his hands.
It is an interesting notion. We would have to deepen our conversations, become completely honest with each other, bear our innermost thoughts and feelings to determine whether we truly share the same goals.
I'm being honest when I tell you that the Republic needs to be torn down and built up again from the ground up.
That is a tall order.
Tall, indeed.
It might require a civil war.
And how far from that are we now?
Dooku fell silent for a moment, then said,
The Senate grapples with trying to solve disputes the Jedi often see firsthand. What laws are enacted only follow from our having brought our lightsabers to bear.
It was the Jedi who pledged to support the Republic.
The Order's place in this is a matter Sifo Dyas and I have discussed endlessly, Dooku snapped. But the members of the Council are not similarly inclined. They are entrenched in archaic thinking and slow to embrace change.
He paused and adopted a sinister look.
Don't let yourself be fooled, Palpatine. They see dark times ahead. In fact, they think of little else. That's why they have allowed the Jedi to become involved in parochial conflicts like those at Galadron, Yinchor, and Baltizar, which are like brush fires born of wind-blown embers from a massive blaze just beyond the horizon. But instead of actually rising up against the corruption in the Republic, perhaps disbanding the Senate entirely for a period of time, they have become fixated on prophecy. They await the coming of a prophesied Redeemer, who will bring balance to the Force and restore order.
A Redeemer?
Palpatine stared at him in authentic surprise.
You've never alluded to this prophecy.
Nor would I now, if I still thought of myself as loyal to the Order.
I never considered that the Force needed to be balanced.
Dooku's lip curled.
The Order interprets the prophecy to mean
that the dark tide needs to be stemmed. You don't accept it? Dooku had an answer ready.
Here is the truth of it. The Jedi could fulfill the prophecy on their own, if they were willing to unleash the full powers of the Force.
The full powers of the Force, Palpatine said. I'm afraid you've lost me. Dooku blew out his breath.
Perhaps it's something we can discuss in the future.
You've made your decision, then?
Dooku nodded. If one more Jedi dies because of indolence on the part of the Republic and moral equivocation on the part of the Council, I will leave the Temple and refuse to look back.
No sooner had Dooku left the office than Sidious was donning his cloak and hurrying off to his next appointment. Hailing a skycab in Senate Plaza, he instructed the grand driver to deliver him to Tanic Spaceport. Relaxing back into the padded seat, he exhaled for what felt like the first time all day. In the space of a standard year, he had gone from leading two lives to managing almost half a dozen. Apprentice to Plagueis, Master to Maul, Distinguished Senator, Ally of Supreme Chancellor Valorum, and leader of a growing cabal of conspirators that included Pestage, Doriana, Grigetus in line to replace him in the Senate, the Force-sensitive human Sim Alu, intelligence analyst Armand Isard, Eriadu Senator Will of Tarkin, and Umbaran telepath Sly Moore, whom he had made his covert aide. And leading a double life of his own, Dooku, carrying out Jedi business while in private moments flirting with the dark side, hungry to bring the full power of the Force to bear in the mundane realm, his slow reorientation, a curious inversion of Darth Gravid's, whose similar reach for preeminence had exceeded his grasp. For the Jedi, mastery was conferred when one attained a true understanding of the ways of the Force. For the Sith, that level of understanding was merely the beginning. The Jedi Order's homespun cloaks announced, "I want for nothing because I am clothed in the Force." The cloaks of the Sith, "I am the light in the dark, the convergence of opposing energies." And yet, while all Sith lords were powerful, not all were brilliant or in complete possession of the powers the dark side granted them. Darth Millennial had rebelled against the teachings of his master, Darth Cognus, and even Plagueis spoke of having reached a philosophical impasse with his master, Tenebris. A human Sith lord whose short reign had elapsed some 5 centuries earlier, Gravid had been persuaded to believe that total commitment to the dark side would sentence the Sith Order to eventual defeat, and so had sought to introduce Jedi selflessness and compassion into his teachings and practice, forgetting that there can be no return to the light for an adept who has entered the dark wood, that the dark side will not surrender one to whom, by mutual agreement, it has staked a claim. Driven increasingly mad by his attempts to straddle the two realms, Gravid became convinced that the only way to safeguard the future of the Sith was to hide or destroy the lore that had been amassed through the generations, the texts, holocrons, and treatises, so that the Sith could fashion a new beginning for themselves that would guarantee success. Barricaded within the walls of a bastion he and his Twi'lek apprentice Gian had constructed on Jagawada, he had attempted as much, and was thought to have destroyed more than half the repository of artifacts before Gian, demonstrating consummate will and courage, had managed to penetrate the force fields Gravid had raised around their stronghold and intercede, killing her master with her bare hands, though at the cost of her arm, shoulder, and the entire left side of her face and chest. A Jedi master of high standing, Dooku possibly already had some theoretical understanding of the dark side. Perhaps more if he had access to Sith holocrons vaulted within the temple. He could certainly be a nuisance to the Republic, though hardly an agent of chaos, as Plagueis Insidious had been. Still, it would be interesting to see just how far Dooku might be willing to go. Palpatine would have to inform Plagueis of their conversation. Or would he? Was an apprentice ever permitted to conceal knowledge from his or her master? No, never. Especially not when there was a chance that Plagueis might learn of Dooku's apostasy on his own, in ways that remained unfathomable. Executing a reckless series of maneuvers, the Grand Driver had changed lanes and was descending rapidly for Tanic Spaceport. A semicircular docking pad, located at the edge of the Manai district and surrounded on all sides by towering monads. Reserved for low-impact freighters, the port was a haven for drugged and abducted crew members, itinerant workers, and undocumented migrants of diverse species, most of whom were in search of steerage passage to distant worlds. Glad to be released from the skycab, Palpatine edged his way into the crowds and set a course for the headquarters of the Refugee Relief Movement, whose stark offices were tucked under the port's recessed upper level. Halfway to his destination, he spied the stout Naboo he had come to see, standing alongside his slender wife and issuing commands to a group of young volunteers. Adopting an expression of good cheer and waving a hand in the air, Palpatine shouted, "Rui!" The man swung to the sound of his voice and smiled broadly.
"Palpatine!"
President of the RRM, Rui Naberi had a large, square head, thin lips, a clean-shaven face, and short hair clipped in high bangs. A one-time mountain man, a builder by trade, and a frequent guest lecturer on microeconomics at Leeds University, he was not easily fooled, and his default expression was one of sincerity. The non-profit organization he directed was devoted to providing aid for Coruscant's billions of lower-tier dwellers.
"What a happy coincidence," Rui said, pumping Palpatine's hand.
The two Naboo were close in age, but Rui was a product of public education rather than the series of private institutions young Palpatine had attended.
"You remember Jobal?"
A tall woman with a triangular-shaped face and wide-spaced and compassionate eyes. She was allowing herself to age gracefully, though her long hair was still dark and luxuriant. Married to Rui by arrangement, she was every bit as serious as he was, and equally committed to the refugee movement.
"Of course," Palpatine said.
Bowing his head, he added,
"Madame Naberi."
She made a move to hug him, then thought better of it, and simply smiled in acknowledgement.
"How good to see you again, Senator."
Rui touched him on the back.
"I never had a chance to thank you in person for allowing me to address the Senate about the refugee crisis on Sev-Tok."
Palpatine shrugged it off.
"It was my honor to be affiliated with such a worthy cause. Speaking of which, Onaconda Farr sends his regards." "Rodia should be proud of him," Rui said. "One of the few in the Senate who recognizes that good fortune should not be taken for granted, but should serve as an impetus for bringing comfort to those less fortunate."
Palpatine smiled tightly.
"What brings you to the dock, Senator?" Jobal asked. "More than coincidence, m'lady. In fact, a matter of utmost urgency that involves your daughter, Padme." "She's here," Rui said.
Palpatine looked at him.
"On Coruscant?" "Here, at Tanic."
He pointed to a nearby dock, where an energetic, dark-haired girl was directing an anti-grav pallet of foodstuffs into the bay of a waiting freighter. Catching sight of her father, Padme waved.
"Who is the young man with her?" Palpatine asked.
"Ian Lago," Jobal said.
Palpatine sharpened his vision.
"The son of King Varuna's counselor?"
Jobal nodded.
"He's become a bit lovesick."
And Padme with him? We hope not, Rui said. Ian's a nice boy, but... Well, let's just say that Khun Lago would not be happy to learn that his son has been fraternizing with the enemy, so to speak.
Realizing that young Ian was eyeing him with sudden interest, Palpatine returned the look for a moment, and then said,
This brings me directly to the point of my visit. As you're no doubt aware, our king has instructed me to support the Trade Federation on the issue of taxation of the free trade zones.
Of course he would, Rui said with clear disdain. How otherwise would Varuna continue to line the pockets of his robes with kickbacks?
Palpatine nodded.
You and I and some of the nobles know as much. But now may be the time to let the rest of Naboo in on his secrets.
Jobal's expression soured. If you're talking about challenging him in the coming election, you're facing a lost cause.
I beg to disagree, madam, Palpatine said. With discretion, I have already approached several members of the electorate, and they concur that Varuna can be defeated by the right candidate.
When he cut his gaze to Padme, Rui's mouth fell open.
You can't be serious. But I am, Rui.
A member of the Legislative Youth Program at 8 years of age? A full apprentice legislator at 11? Her refugee work on Shada Biboran? Plus, she enjoys more popular support in Theed than any governor has enjoyed in generations.
Jobal blinked and shook her head in disbelief. Palpatine, she has only just turned 13. Palpatine spread his hands.
Naboo has elected younger queens, m'lady, and hers could be a reign that will last 50 years.
He refused to yield to Rui or Jobal.
The Constitution has a provision that would allow the monarchy to become hereditary for a worthy dynasty. And what more worthy family is there than the Naberis?
Husband and wife traded looks.
That's very flattering, Senator,
Jobal started to say when Palpatine cut her off.
The Naboo are exasperated with monarchs like Tapelo and Varuna. Padme would allow Naboo to reinvent itself.
Rui mulled it over momentarily.
Even if Padme were to entertain the idea, I'm not sure she could be persuaded to support taxation of the trade zones, knowing what that might mean for Naboo and other outlying worlds.
She wouldn't have to take a stand, Palpatine countered. She need only campaign against corruption and secret deals, and the embarrassing position in which Varuna has placed Naboo.
Jobal's eyes narrowed in uncertainty.
At the risk of touching on a sore point, Senator. You helped put Varuna on the throne, and have been his advocate ever since.
Palpatine shook his head.
Never an advocate. I have always considered myself to be a counterbalance. And in the past few years, we found ourselves on opposite sides of almost every issue, including the library he built and the credits he lavished on creating a space force for Naboo.
He fell silent for a moment, then said, Trust me, Varuna can be defeated. Again, Rui and Jobal exchanged worried looks.
We're provincial people, Palpatine,
Rui said at last.
The world of politics, galactic politics, no less.
Palpatine compressed his lips.
I understand. But what compelled the two of you to abandon the mountains for Theed, if not for Padme and Sola, and the opportunities that might be available to them?
Palpatine held Rui's pensive gaze. He is beginning to waver.
I wouldn't want to put Padme through this only to see her lose, Palpatine.
Palpatine beamed.
I will work with you to see that that doesn't happen. I don't wish to speak out of turn, but I can almost guarantee the support of the Supreme Chancellor as well.
Valorum knows of Padme? Jobal asked in delighted surprise.
Of course he does, Palpatine paused. Faced with Padme as competition, perhaps Varuna will see the light and abdicate.
Jobal laughed, then showed Palpatine a serious look.
You have come a long way, Senator.